And CPT is what relates matter and antimatter. So it looks like the laws of physics do not care about labeling something matter or antimatter. They see in the same way an electron and a positron, or a proton and an antiproton.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, do we need all the CPT for this, or CP is enough?
You need, so to do not distinguish between matter and antimatter, that's the statement that your theory is CPT invariant. Now, sorry, what is CPT invariance? This assumes that you have some quantum field theory that is Lorentz invariant, and also assume some locality, that interactions are local. So the derivation of CPT invariance is based on this set of assumptions. Obviously, there are lots of experimental searches for CPT violation, because CPT violation will mean immediately that there is a Lorentz violation.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Maybe it's a stupid question, but I thought that charge conjugation related matter and antimatter.
It does relate a guy that has a negative charge, electric charge, to positive electric charge. But this is not enough. So to really change from matter to antimatter, you need to charge conjugation, parity, and time reversal. You need the three things at the same time. Essentially, because you see charge invariance relates this guy and this guy, but that doesn't tell you that the mass is the same or the width is the same. Okay, so how do we look for CPT violation? We go to systems where we have matter and antimatter, for example, the Kaon system. And we look for differences between matter and antimatter. In this case, between a particle, Kaon, and an antiparticle, the anti-Kaon. The Kaon system is the best place to look, or the most precise measurement of non-CPT invariance. And what they do is they look for Kaon and anti-Kaon oscillations. And the idea is that these oscillations are ruled by an equation of the of the form, the time variation of your Kaon system. In this case, psi is Kaon. Sorry, and anti-Kaon is going to be given by some matrix, lambda, and your original vector. And this lambda is just the mass matrix and the width matrix. So this is a 2x2 matrix. And when you look at the system, CPT invariance means that the entry, the diagonal entries must be the same. So what they do is they look at the Kaon system, they measure the oscillations very, very carefully, and then they impose bounds on things like a parameter called delta, which is proportional to lambda 1,1 minus lambda 2,2. If there were any CPT violation in the system, we will measure a non-zero value for delta. So far, what we know from delta, experimentally, is that it's below or the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. This is for the real part, and this is for the imaginary part. So CPT violation has not been observed, and this is the degree of position of the non-observation. And because CPT violation has not been observed, well, there is also no Lorentz violation fair either. So all this is to tell you that CPT violation seems to be a pretty solid symmetry. Yes?
So the supposed Lorentz violation that was observed in Eugenio last year, is that within that experiment, what, is that something related to this parameter or?
So CPT violation implies Lorentz violation, but not vice versa.
Oh, I see.
I'm not sure whether the violation that you will see in the neutrino sector will be also CPT violation. But it's a good question. I don't know. Yes?
What do you exactly mean by locality?
Locality is, essentially, there is no action at a distance. I mean, an electron and a positron, let's say, interact with a photon, but this interaction is local, right? It happens at a particular point in space-time. Yes.
But we don't think about them as exact particles, do we?
Yeah, so it's a wave function that is localizing, has an overlap everywhere, right?
Yeah.
But let's say, what you will do is to compute the overlapping of these two wave functions. Okay? So when, I guess what you mean is, what is non-locality? What is the intuition of non-locality? Well, non-locality could be something like an electron is propagating in a space, it disappears, and then appears again here. Like, it's pretty wild. So assuming locality is not something that we worry about so much. Interactions seem to be local. Yes.
The CPT. So, what is the CPT of a Lorentz neutrino?
So.
The CPT conjugate.
Good question. We are going to talk after baryogenesis. We look at the we talk about neutrino masses. And yesterday you did a tutorial about Dirac and Majorana fermions, right? So. What CPT does, so an electron, the antiparticle is a Dirac fermion, and the antiparticle is a positron, right? Whereas a neutrino, it could be that it's on antiparticle, is its own antiparticle. Or in other words, it could be that neutrino is the same as the antiparticle. That's only true if neutrinos are Majorana fermions. All right. So when you ask me what are the CPT transformations of neutrinos, it depends if they are Majorana or Dirac.
But if they were not Majorana, then we would have CPT violation. Is there
one? No, what it would mean is under CPT, assuming CPT, the neutrino would be the same as the antineutrino. So don't get lost. The CPT is a symmetry that we often assume because it has been tested very well. It's something that is derived from assumptions that are kind of reasonable. Quantum field theory, well tested. Lorentz invariance, symmetries of space-time and locality, all things that kind of make sense. So CPT is often considered a fundamental symmetry of nature, no doubt. There are people working on Lorentz violation. So there is always people working on the possibility of violating CPT, but it is often assumed. So CPT is the thing that relates matter and antimatter. If this is a fundamental symmetry of nature, how can it be that the universe is violating CPT to that level? Right? There is only matter, and only matter. There is a lot of matter. There is almost no antimatter. Yes.
Why are you talking about CPT if the Sakharov conditions only require violation of CPT?
You're moving ahead. Yes, I'm going to talk about CPT, Sakharov conditions in a second. Did you see them before in another?
Yeah, we did that.
In cosmology? Oh, that's great. Excellent. So, assuming CPT, how can we obtain a variable asymmetry in the universe? And that's where we are going to go into the Sakharov conditions. Okay. So, in order to tell you what is the baryon asymmetry of the universe, first we need to talk about, again, the Komobin volume. So, one thing we know is that the total entropy in a Komobin volume is constant. So when we look at the entropy density, which is the total entropy divided by the Komobin volume, because this guy is constant, then the entropy density is proportional to the volume minus one. Okay, so the way you define baryon asymmetry is to say, I want to count how many baryons minus how many antibaryons I have in the universe, right? And this is going to be what we call the number, so the density of baryons minus the density of antibaryons multiplied by the Komobin volume. So this is the asymmetry in the baryon, the baryon asymmetry, and it's related to the baryon density multiplied by the volume. But now the volume is related to the entropy. And this is a useful parametrization because the entropy is also related to the density. Well, it's more or less equal to 7 times the density of photons. I don't know if you've seen that in the cosmology course, but essentially the entropy receives contributions from all the species, and you look at the contribution from the number of photons, there is a constant of proportionality, it's about 7. Okay, so we can look at this asymmetry, and because now the entropy density is proportional to the volume, to the minus one, then we can define a parameter, eta, which is going to be number of baryons, number of antibaryons, density, divided by the number of photons. And you know that this parameter is independent of the, well, it's a constant in the Komobin volume because of the volume dependence factors. Right? So entropy goes as volume to the minus one. Number of photons goes as entropy. So now if I want to obtain this asymmetry, this baryon asymmetry, well, I can divide by the number of photons and I get something that is independent of the particular Komobin volume. This number has been measured by WMAP very precisely, and is of order 10 to the minus 10. So when we look at there at the density of photons and the density of baryons minus antibaryons, we see that this difference is very small compared with the density of photons. This is the baryon asymmetry. So all models of baryogenesis are trying to explain this specific number. It has been measured very, very carefully. So the question, coming back to what you were saying, is, okay, so this very small number is telling us that the universe that we observe right now is very asymmetric. How can we obtain such an asymmetry without CPT violation? And this is the question. How can we obtain such a difference between baryons, matter and antimatter, without violating CPT invariance? And there we come to the Sakharov conditions. obviously, to obtain baryon number asymmetry, we need to violate baryon number, right? So first of all, we need baryon number violation. Okay. The second condition is that we need some CP violation, and I'm going to explain why. And the third condition, and this is very hard also to obtain, is we need out of equilibrium. We cannot have all these CP violating, baryon violating processes at equilibrium. So let's go over these conditions. And I think the first one is quite clear. If I don't violate baryon number, I'm not going to generate any baryon asymmetry. So that's OK. So it means that there is some process that goes from an initial state to a final state that violates baryon number. They say that this process violates baryon number by an amount A. A can be 1, 2, 3, violates some amount of baryon number. So if a charge conjugation is conserved, what it means is that besides having initial to final, you also have anti-initial from the final. All right. This violates baryon number by an amount A. This other guy violates baryon numbers by an amount minus A. So assuming charge conjugation leads to the conclusion that you have the same amount of initial going to final and anti-initial going to anti-final. So you have processes that violate baryon number by an amount A, but you also have the processes that violate baryon number by the same amount as with a minus sign. So if C is conserved, that would lead to delta B equals 0. Okay. So now, if CP is conserved, because CPT is conserved, it means that time reversal D is conserved, right? So if CP, the charge conjugation and parity are conserved, and because we know that CPT is conserved, that would mean that T time reversal is conserved. Let me see. Okay. All right? So what it means is that you have the same amount of initial going to final as to final going to initial. And for the same token, if this violates baryon number by an amount, this does it by the opposite amount. So you end up with no baryon number violation. So you see, even if we start with baryon violating interactions, and let's say one of these processes is initial to final, if charge or CP are conserved individually, then we erase all the baryon number, the total baryon number. Is it clear or I'm going too fast? So it seems that we need to violate CP in order to generate a net number of baryon asymmetry. What about out of equilibrium? Why do we need to be out of equilibrium? That's a little bit trickier. So assume that we had a thermal equilibrium. In the thermal equilibrium, the number density of any species X, whichever, goes as the exponential of the mass minus the chemical potential divided by the temperature. That's the Boltzmann distribution. So now, because baryon number is violated, then you can have things like a guy X goes to another guy X bar, and they annihilate to produce two photons. So now X is a baryon, and X bar is the antibaryon. And because CPT is conserved, well, when you take the particle and the antiparticle, they annihilate to produce photons. So if we look at these kind of processes, if they are in chemical equilibrium, that means that the chemical potential at the beginning and the chemical potential at the end have to equate. And what is the chemical potential of a photon when it boson is zero? So that means that the chemical potential of the baryon and the antibaryon are opposite. And then my baryon asymmetry is proportional to the number of baryons minus the number of antibaryons. And then if I put it here, I get that this guy is proportional to the hyperbolic sinus of mu x over t. Okay? So I just get the exponential of plus mu x minus the exponential of minus mu x. And that gives me something proportional to the hyperbolic sinus. But now, because the baryon number is violated, I could also have things like could have processes that go like two of these baryons go to two of these antibaryons. And if these kind of processes are in chemical equilibrium, again, that leads to mu of x equals zero, the chemical potential is zero, and that leads to beta. Because the density of baryons and antibaryons also disappear. Okay, so any questions about all this? So we started assuming there is CPT invariance. If we allow some amount of baryon violation, some processes that allow baryon violation, this is not enough. Because any amount of baryon violation you produce in any particular process will be offset by any other kind of process as long as CP is conserved and as long as equilibrium, thermal equilibrium is still there. So if you fail to provide these three conditions at the same time, out of equilibrium, baryon violating processes and CP violating processes, then any amount of baryon violation you get, it will be wiped out. Is it clear? Okay. So What the Sakharov conditions tells you is that it is possible to generate an asymmetry of the universe, assuming CPT is conserved, but it is not very easy. You need to fulfill these three conditions at the same time. Yes?
Well, it seems to me that CPT is not enough precisely measured. Well, it should be measured up to 10 to the power of minus 10. Then I would be sure that it's not responsible for this baryon genesis.
Be careful, right? Because you say, because delta is measured of the order of 10 to the minus 4.
Right.
And eta is measured of the order of 10 to the minus 10. So it looks like I need to very precisely measure CPT violation before saying this. But these are not parametrically the same things. You don't know how this accuracy translates into these numbers.
Right.
So what I can tell you is that the accuracy on delta is enough to assure that this, even if there were some CPT violation at this level, that wouldn't be enough as to produce this asymmetry. But it's good to think about these kind of things. Is 10 to the minus 4 enough as to, let's say that the CPT violation appear at a value of delta of order 10 to the minus 6 or so? Imagine that that's what happens. They measure the Lecamp system much better. Would that explain this 10 to the minus 10? No, it wouldn't. So the question is that you don't know exactly how this measurement enters here. Okay, so CPT violation out of your mind for the moment. If CPT is conserved, we can still explain the baryon asymmetry of the universe, but it requires these three conditions, Sakharov conditions. So you will say, okay, is that easy to obtain or difficult? And in particular, you can ask if the standard model is able to fulfill these three conditions. So we need baryon violation, we need a CP violation, and we need out of equilibrium conditions. Do you know anything about baryon violation in the standard model? Do you know if it's conserved or not? How about them?
It is conserved.
Okay, so you heard that you had this intuition probably that baryon number is conserved in the standard model, but it isn't. So it is conserved perturbatively. But in the standard model, there are non-perturbative effects, in this case, instantons, that violate baryon number. Essentially, this instanton has to do with the non-trivial structure of SG2 left. You know that baryons transform protons, transform under SG2 left, and SG2 left has a particular topological structure that leads to non-perturbative violation of baryon number. So baryon number, it is violated in the standard model. Yes?
So this SU2 left, is that the SU2 of weak interaction?
Yes. So when you put it, but electro weak is SU2 left, because you want hypercharge. Because SU2 left is a non-abelian theory. I don't know if ever you heard about that, but there is an interesting structure, non-perturbative structure of non-abelian theories. The way the SU2 winding number wraps around a topological structure. So this is a very interesting stuff beyond the scope of this course. The question is, there is a mechanism in the standard model to violate baryon number. This baryon number violation is very suppressed. So but a number is violated, but it's very suppressed. Now, but it wasn't. At a high temperature. So in the past history of the universe, there was a moment in which instanton, or in this case, spallaron interactions were active. So there are moments in the past where baryon number can be sizable. Okay, so that's fine. The standard model violates baryon number, yes?
So the instanton that was responsible for the baryon violation is called Stalleron?
What is this story of the instanton? It's just telling you that there is a set of degenerate vacuum that had different winding numbers.
Right.
So in principle, if you want to go from a vacuum of B equals zero to another vacuum of a non-zero baryon number, you need to go tunneling.
Right.
And that's why this is very suppressed at low temperatures. So the instanton effects are non-perturbative, but they are very suppressed. But there is a way around that. If you give enough temperature, enough energy, then you can, instead of tunneling, you can jump over this. And this solution, which is a solution at a non-zero temperature, is called a sphaleron. This is an instanton solution. So instantons are very suppressed, spherons are not at a high temperature. So baryon number is violated. What about CP violation? Do you know if the standard model violates CP?
Yeah.
Right, okay. It does. And you know the name of the CP violating phase?
CP matrix.
Way good. So this CP violation is encoded inside the CKM matrix. And this the phase inside this matrix is called the delta CKM. There is a phase there. And it's responsible for CP violation. Right. Okay. And what about out of equilibrium? That's a little bit trickier. How do we get into out of equilibrium conditions in the universe? There are two instances where you get out of equilibrium. Most of the time, you know, the universe is just expanding. The interaction rate inside the commoving volume is quite high. So the particles are interacting very fast, and you reach thermal equilibrium very easily. So in fact, it's kind of difficult to see a moment where we get out of equilibrium. But there are two possibilities. One of them is the case. So when you have a heavy particle that decays into light particles, this process is out of equilibrium thermally. So we can generate some baryon asymmetry through decays of heavy particles. The other instance of out of equilibrium is phase transitions. Do you know of any phase transitions in the history of the universe? Heard about that?
Inflation,
okay, what else?
What?
Inflation?
UT breaking.
What?
EUT breaking.
EUT?
Gut breaking.
Ah, gut breaking. If there was a gut breaking, yes.
There was a
recombination.
Recombination of? What else?
Big Bang itself.
A long time ago. So you know about the electroweak phase transition? So before the electroweak phase transition, the universe was electroweak symmetric. After the electroweak phase transition, well, we break electroweak symmetry into electromagnetism. So
isn't it that the same time as inflation?
No, it's, well, inflation could be as low as before the Big Bang increasing, no, yes, BBN, right? And so it could be below a little bit free transition. But the usual common law is to assume that inflation happened at a very high scale. But you're right, it could be as low as BBN, which is below a little bit. Any other phase transition?
That's chiral symmetry breaking.
So chiral symmetry breaking is another phase transition. So in both cases, these phase transitions are due to some spontaneous symmetry breaking, where we go from a little bit symmetric vacuum filling the universe to a little bit broken universe. Or in this case, we go from the quark gluon plasma to get to the meson subvariant that we see nowadays. During phase transitions, there is a chance of getting out of equilibrium. So all the theories of baryogenesis either use decays or use phase transitions. In this case, the electroweak phase transition. So there are theories of baryogenesis based on some heavy particle, baryon number violating particle decays. Or one very common proposal is what is called electroweak baryogenesis. It's very nice because right now at the LHC we are looking at the electroweak phase transition. We are opening the window to this particular moment in the history of the universe. So if baryogenesis happened at the electroweak scale, we will see it too at the LHC. So that's pretty exciting. Whereas this other possibility of generating baryogenesis at high scales, heavy particle decays, well, it's a pity because we won't be able to produce this particle at the Large Hadron Collider. So electroweak baryogenesis is very popular. Okay, so in the standard model, we have the three conditions. So why do I say that this is beyond the standard model? Well, you can guess. It's because although the standard model is closed, it has everything, all the ingredients, it doesn't get there. So you look in particular when you put all together for the standard model, you get that the asymmetry generated in the standard model is of order number 10 to the minus 8 times the phase of CP violation. And this 10 to the minus 8 contains all the information about spiron transitions plus electroweak phase transition. So once you compute these things numerically, then you get that the amount of asymmetry you generated is some number times your CP violating phase. This is of order one essentially in the standard model. But it's actually order 10 to the minus. Not order 1, 10 to the minus in the standard model. So the amount of asymmetry is number that has to do with the dynamics of the electroweak phase transition times, and also the dynamics of baryon violation times something that is related, this is related but it's not, to the CP violating phase in CKM matrix, which is order one. It's an order one phase. So when you account for everything there, then you end up with something that is of order 10 to the minus 20. All right. So it's a pity because the standard model has everything. It just has everything in a very small amount. It doesn't have enough out of equilibrium. It doesn't have enough CP violation, and it doesn't generate enough baryon number violation. So the Sakharov conditions are fulfilled, but in practice, this barrier violation is not enough. So if this is claiming for beyond the standard model, and what beyond the standard model needs to provide is new phases that violate CP, and it needs to provide.
Question?
Yes.
Could we increase this number by assuming that the phase transition was the chiral symmetry or something? But that baryogenesis happened there.
So the problem is that you need your universe to be asymmetric at the time of BBN.
Right.
So this cannot be done at the chiral phase transition. You need to do it before that. That's a really good question. That may change a little bit this number. So BSM requires new phases of CP violation and new ways of getting out of equilibrium, and maybe new sources of barium violation. The problem is that any new sources of barium violation are very constrained by the proton lifetime. So this is kind of hard. This is given by most models. It's difficult to write down a model that doesn't introduce new CP violating phases. It's very specific of the CKM matrix to have only one phase. And new ways of out of equilibrium, well, so you can do that by new particles decaying, by adding more stuff into the electroweak phase transition. You can do in many ways. And for example, supersymmetry provides these two guys. It provides new phases and also new ways of strengthening the electroweak baryogenesis, the phase transition at the electroweak scale. Okay. So, to explain the matter antimatter asymmetry of the universe, we need beyond the standard model. So let's move into the third evidence for BSM. And this is neutrino masses. I left neutrino masses for the end because this is one of these evidences that is very nice, but very hard to come out with a beyond the standard model that can be seen in the near future. Whenever we want to add masses to neutrinos, usually we add new stuff, but this new stuff is at high energies, and those are energies we will never reach. So it's kind of disappointing, but it is worth mentioning. So the evidence number three is neutrino masses. I don't know if you heard this in the standard model course previously, but there is a difference between flavor eigenstates and mass eigenstates. Flavor eigenstates are states that interact in a very specific way. For example, the W guy can interact with an electron and a neutrino, antineutrino of the type electron. So the way you define your neutrino electron type is to say that the neutrino electron type is the one that interacts with the electron with this W. So this is the guy that has very definite ways of interacting. And the same you could do the W into a muon and a muon neutrino. And this is the way you label the muon neutrino. But what you measure, the physical eigenstates, the things that propagate, are the things that have a definite mass. So imagine I have this theory, a theory where the neutrino electron interacts this way, the muon electron, neutrino, interacts this way. But now I decide to write down a mass term that relates the electron neutrino and the muon neutrino. Some mass that mixes the electron and the muon neutrinos. So you take this theory with the very, very definite interactions, but now it has this mixing in the mass term. To see what are the physical, the propagating eigenstates, you have to diagonalize this interaction, right? This mass matrix. So at the end of the day, you are going to end up with two mass eigenstates. No. After diagonalization, you are going to have these two guys with mass M1 and mass M2. And these are going to be some linear combination of the flavor eigenstates. And you can visualize this thinking that in practice, what happens is that I have a neutrino, U1. This guy has a very definite mass, M1, and it's propagated with a propagator, you know, P slash plus M1. And when it comes to interactions, the probability of interacting with a W and an electron, or the probability of interacting with a W and a muon, will depend on these coefficients here.
Why don't the neutrinos and anti-neutrinos mix?
Like in the count system, you mean?
Why don't a neutrino oscillate between a neutrino and an anti-neutrino?
The same as in the count system, yeah, it could be. But what we are saying is, well, I'm going reverse, right? I'm going to tell you that actually we observe oscillations between the electron neutrinos and the muon neutrinos. These oscillations in time are due to having a mass of this kind. So another question is what you're saying. Yeah, it could be that you have some mixing, or there's an oscillation between the neutrino electron and antineutrino electron. You could have that. More questions? Okay, so there is always a difference between flavor eigenstates and physical or mice eigenstates. This is the, for example, here, this is the way they appear. And you can visualize them as saying, I have my propagating particle, but then when it comes to interactions, it may interact with a W and get out an electron or a muon in this case. By obtaining an electron or a muon out of it depends on this coefficient C1 and C2. So it was more or less understood how many electron neutrinos we get out of the sun, and when we measure them, they seem to be less than expected. Why? Because measuring them means obtaining an electron or a muon, and there were less electrons than expected. So there was a deficit of neutrinos. And precisely seeing this deficit is a manifestation that neutrinos have some mass. If it wasn't for this mass term, we couldn't see this deficit, this time oscillation. Okay. So why is this beyond the standard model? Because the standard model doesn't have enough ingredients as to give a mass to the neutrinos. In the standard model, you have, if you just look at the SE2 quantum numbers, you will have an electron and a neutrino. This is a left-handed electron, whereas this is a 2, a doublet of SE2, whereas you have a right-handed electron as a singlet of SE2. Yes.
Sorry, just going back to the argument, why, how we know that there is a neutrino mass, the observation was that we did not observe enough electrons. Therefore,
exactly.
There must be a, some neutrinos must be oscillating to muons.
Exactly. Yes. So, so we just need to give some mass to the neutrinos. What is the big deal? The problem is that in the standard model, to give a mass, we need to do some neutrino left, neutrino right type of thing. For example, we can give it with the Higgs. But there is no right-handed neutrino in the standard model. So this is missing in the standard model. So neutrino masses are an evidence for beyond the standard model because you need either a right-handed neutrino or you need some new interactions that give you a mass for the neutrinos.
Oh, but this is easy. I mean,
yes. That's why I left it for the end. Yes. So, add an extra neutrino. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
Yes. I live with that. Like, you could add a Yukawa here. This Yukawa would be much, 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 much smaller than the electron. But okay, the electron Yukawa is much smaller than the top, and we are not, you know, taking off our hair. So, yeah. That's an easy fix, but still it calls for beyond the standard model. The standard model cannot be the end of the picture. Okay.
Okay, but this, so you only add this, you only add the mass for this there, but if you were to add it in the doublet, then you would have a CK, like a CKM kind of negative, right?
Sorry? So, the quick fix is to do this, right?
Yeah.
And you are saying that this will add new sources of CP violation?
Well, I'm not sure because you are only adding this term in the singlets of SU2.
Yes, so that won't add any new sources in this. But yeah, you can cook up others which give you more sources of CP violation. This is just one option, the simplest. Add an extra neutrino, singlet of SU2, who cares? Well, okay. But then it is interesting because, as you learned in the tutorial yesterday, the neutrino is a fermion, as most of the things in the standard model, but it's also neutral. Is there any other neutral fermion in the standard model? So there's no other neutral fermion, and the neutrino being a fermion and neutral, you can have two choices. It can be Dirac, as everybody else in the standard model, or it could be Majorana. Remember that Majorana means this, and this will violate charge conjugation unless the guy is neutral. So the neutrinos are the only components of the standard model who could be Majorana or Dirac. So if we discover that the neutrino has a Majorana nature, it will be the first instance of such a thing in nature. We haven't observed any Majorana fermions ever. And neutrinos could be those guys.
So
yes.
if a fermion is Dirac, it's charged, right?
You could have a Dirac fermion that is electrically neutral, no problem.
So the phase transformation, which is
it will, so you would just know that mu is different from uc, Essentially, this is a, from the initial 4 degrees of freedom of your fermion.
Right.
By this condition, you get to 2 degrees of freedom.
Right.
But this condition can only be completed for a neutral light. So charged fermions had to be Dirac, whereas neutral fermions could keep their 4 degrees of freedom. It could be that they don't fulfill this condition. That's okay. But it could be also that they are the antiparticle. That's also possible. But as I said, we haven't observed any Majorana fermion in nature except in condensed matter. So condensed matter physicists have been able to create states, pseudo-particles, who behave as Majorana particles, but never in the standard model. Let me just finish introducing the next chapter, which is the rationale for new physics. So I told you that even if there wasn't any variant asymmetry in the, well, if there was any variant asymmetry in the universe, we wouldn't be here talking, but that's okay. Or we didn't know about neutrino masses, or we didn't know about dark matter, we'll still, I think we will feel uncomfortable about the standard model. And this is because there is some rationale for new physics. So those are reasons to indicate new physics, but are not based on experimental evidence, are just based on our understanding of quantum field theory and the way it works. And I often separate this rationale into different sets. One of them is hierarchies. We don't like to see very widely separated numbers, things that are of the same origin, but happen to have very different values. So there are a bunch of hierarchies in the standard model, gauge, fermion, masses, and also in flavor. So I'm going to explain all these hierarchies, and we don't like those. And to explain how these hierarchies can appear, you call to be on the standard model. The other type of rationale is what I call end of the road. Essentially, those are things that either something shows up at this moment, at this energy, or our understanding of quantum field theory breaks down. And those are unitarity and also perturbativity. Because we want to preserve unitarity in the standard model, but we realize that something must show up at the TEV scale. And perturbativity is, you want wishful thinking. Because we want to keep using perturbative analysis, we need to call for beyond the standard model office. So tomorrow I'm going to explain the different rationale for new physics, starting from hierarchies, which are very hard thing to explain. And most of the models of beyond the standard model, supersymmetry, extra dimensions, technicolor, their motivation starts always with the gauge hierarchy. So I'll explain that. I think that's it. Okay, so I'll see you tomorrow. And I hope my voice will be better.